At the end of the second hour on Friday, I had one of the fairly common disagreements with IQ Al-Rasuli. And, you know, when we disagree, it's usually on the details. In this particular case, I don't think we were disagreeing on the details. I think we're disagreeing on something very fundamental. And it's I want to pick back up where we left off in the first hour here today. I applaud Putin for saying what nobody wants to say. And it's the absolute truth. That to remove Assad from power, which is what the United States and Europe are committed to doing, is counterproductive. Just as it was in Afghanistan, just as it was in Libya, just as it was in Iraq. We have absolute proof that removing a secular dictator from power in an Islamic country is counterproductive. Whoever replaces him will be worse, if anyone replaces him, or if it's just marauding terrorists. So I applaud Putin for acknowledging that, that the world, if it wants to deal with the Islamic State, should fight on behalf of Assad rather than to replace Assad. But IQ was of the belief that Putin somehow, because, you know, he doesn't have to answer to anybody, and he is more pragmatic, that he is going to prevail in Syria and is going to keep Assad in power and keep the city-state of Damascus upright.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. In fact, I'm quite sure of it. It's going to work out the other way. So I left the Friday show by saying, you know, Russia had a lot at stake in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and it was fighting a de minimis foe by comparison. That was the propped up Taliban and Al-Qaeda, propped up with American weapons, and it lost badly with 10 times the troop presence and aircraft presence in Afghanistan than it has in Syria. So why would you think that the Russians are going to prevail in Syria?
They can't.
They can't. They won't.
But they could escalate it to a nuclear war. That's the horror of it all.
Yeah, I think what they can do is
put your dog in a corner, you know, or a rat in a corner, man. They just eventually they're going to give everything they got.
Correct. Yeah, it can escalate. In fact, it will escalate the Syrian, Iraqi, Iranian conflict to world war. Now, that is going to do. And it's going to delay the fall of Assad so that all of this transpires in 2026 and 2027, and that that the Islamic State, Sunni, Shia, Iran, Saudi Arabia battles are going to continue on for the next 10 years. That's what it assures, yes.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And in terms of what you were talking about earlier about oil, oil is certainly a huge variable in these equations,
mm-hmm.
but ultimately ideology and agendas trump this. We know about the globalist agenda, and, you know, mm-hmm. It seems to me that, you know, in that region of the world, they're, you know, using the Sunni-Shia conflict for consolidation. Ultimately, they, you know, I believe they want to get rid of all nationalist and local cultural identity, to have the whole world in submission to thinking globally and being a good global citizen and all this
yeah,
stuff.
I don't think they are delusional to the sense that they can rob a Shiite Muslim or a Sunni Muslim of their identity. That's never going to happen.
No. I'm not saying religious identity. I'm talking about national cultural identity mostly. But ultimately, let's remember, I still think that we're going to see a consolidation of the Islamic world over the next 10 years. You know,
mm-hmm.
this is how we're going to get to the Magog War. And,
yeah.
you know, it seems that ultimately probably the Sunnis will prevail. And that's how we're going to see the alignment, you know, of these powers fall into place for the Magog War. And let's not forget, Israel is described
as... But now think about it. With Russia involved, what is it going to take for the Sunnis to prevail? I mean, are they going to go to war? You know, there is no way that Sunni Islam can defeat Russia. So what do Sunnis need to do to go to war? It's the inevitable fall of Shia Islam is not nearly as obvious as it previously was. Now, we know from Yahweh's prophecy in Yeshaya 17 that the Russians are going to fail, that Assad is going to fail, and that the city-state of Damascus is going to be in ruins, and Syria is going to fall. Yeah, we know all of that. And Israel's going to be blamed, and Israel's going to be forced to give up the West Bank, and then Muslims by the tens of millions are going to flood into to Israel as terrorists. We know all of that. But it's really just how the pieces line up between now and then that I find interesting. And I'm convinced that what Kirk represented in the last hour is a huge part of this, because as it relates to consolidation of power, there are only two things that matter in today's world. One is, whose weapons are you wielding? And number two, how are you integrated with the one universal economic currency today, which is oil?
Well, the world is awash in cheap oil at the moment. We have this discovery of these huge new, you know, reserves, I think, in the Golan, right?
Right.
There are all these, and then you have issues of, like, the U.S. with the Liberty rig and all those types of things. And the world is awash in oil. Certainly it figures into the equation. You know, I mean, there's going to be a lot of wrangling.
Yeah, the Israeli oil reserves are never going to have a significant impact on the world. They're just going to be looked at with envy by the Muslims. They're going to make Muslims more envious of them. But the fact is that the world's only awash in oil right now because the Saudis are trying to bankrupt the Iranians driving down the price of oil. That's the reason that oil fell, and it's maintained a reasonably low level. But the reality is that the distribution of oil and the monies that are made on that is what caused the alliance between Russia and Iran in the first place. It's what caused the alliance between China and Iran. You know, Russia and Iran, China and Shiite Islam, they have no natural ties. So the 100% of the alliance is based on oil. And, you know, here you have the same thing existing in Syria. Syria is, and Afghanistan were the two battlegrounds for pipelines, for the distribution of oil. And so these are the two issues today. You know, the globalists want to control the distribution and sale of oil and the distribution and sale of weapon systems.
Right.
And Syria is a direct result of that. The Ukraine. You know, where was the Russians' premier pipeline? Through the Ukraine. You know, what is bringing the Ukrainians into NATO? What does it do? It changes their source of supply of oil and changes their source of weapons.
Right. Another disturbing element of this whole thing is how important individual significant men are in some of these political situations. If Putin, you know, God forbid, were taken out, if Assad were taken out, in America, if Donald Trump were taken out, too many of these, you know, significant ideological issues hinge on the charisma and will of individual men. If they cease to be present, then who knows what's going to happen.
Can I throw another wrinkle into this?
Yeah, please.
Let me first acknowledge Terry is the one that looks all this stuff up and listens to all these people, and then I go in and look at all the footnotes because I don't want to bring it up unless I've done a little bit of research and at least enough to feel confident to quote some of these people who dig up all this research. There's another aspect that I had never even considered. I always thought that government was against big business. And because the way they holler at one another and everything, and then if you go back to my generation that took civics classes, governments raised taxes and used tariffs to create wealth in order to do the things they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it was that we're not profit-making things, there was a guy that came on radio, and if you read all his footnotes and all his research, you go, my God, the government's private, the state, locals, and federal governments
mm-hmm.
are worth trillions.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that, and I should have, because I lived in Orange County where all of a sudden they went bankrupt one time
mm-hmm.
because they made bad investments. And I thought to myself, well, what the hell are we in the stock market for? Why is the
mm-hmm.
Orange County in the stock market?
Because of the pension plans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about 1 in 4 workers in America work for the government.
Correct.
And they control the pension plans. I know you had a big company, and I've worked for a company that had a 401k once, and
mm-hmm.
and those things, they give you a choice. They say you can put it in the bank at no return, you can put it at a safe return, you can put it in a
risky.
Basically, they just tell you what, you know, those are the offers. You got to put it in something.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically are directing that. They control that.
Mm-hmm.
If you control as much wealth as these do, and the guys,
mm-hmm.
yes,
because of the pension plans and the health care plans.
And all that stuff, his point was, and he showed you how to document it, you can actually, this is all public record stuff you can
mm-hmm.
get. These places are worth, these governments are worth
mm-hmm.
in the tens of trillions,
mm-hmm.
and they are business. They can put anybody on any board of any major.
Yes, they can.
That's
because of the amount that they manipulate.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So now that means that these guys are in bed. The government and big business are the one and the same.
Yeah, it is, and only to a certain extent.
Okay.
And that is that they do have significance because of the pension share ownership. This would be state and local government pension share ownership. And public entity unions, like the teachers union, for example, which is a union for public employees, that the amount of money that they control as investments can influence a board of directors. Now, boards of directors are the most useless, most counterproductive thing in the world. There is no corporation in America that listens to its board of directors. What they do is they have their quarterly board meetings where they put together a package for the board that very few board members even read, and then they put on a song and dance program for the board members, wine and dine them, and the board rubber stamps what the management wishes to do. So the influence on boards is overrated. Movie on Friday was that. If you look at Al-Qaeda, which was conceived by the United States, by Zygmunt Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter, to try to recruit jihadists to wield weapons that we were providing to the Taliban, menace the Russians in Afghanistan to the point that the Russians withdrew from Afghanistan, that this undercover CIA project resulted in the Russians being bludgeoned to the point that they retreated from Afghanistan. Now, if you were to compare the Islamic State to the combination of the database recruiting of Al-Qaeda and the jihadist training of the Taliban and the weapons deployed by both, anybody that doesn't recognize the Islamic State is 10 times as numerous, 10 times better armed, 10 times more skilled in deploying those weapons, 10 times better entrenched, 10 times the foe that the Taliban in Afghanistan was, and they ousted the Russians in Afghanistan, which is a neighboring country. What do you think the chances are that Russia is going to prevail against the Islamic State when they lost so badly at the peak of their power in Afghanistan?
Well, they also have advisors from us, if you believe this stuff on the 2006 documents. We're not opposed to telling Saudi Arabia, tell them to do this if they want to do it indirectly. I'm not sure we wouldn't do it directly.
Yeah, you know, it was an amazing story that came out of Baghdad last week, where Russian generals and Iranian generals are now working on behalf of the special forces from Iran, deploying them throughout Iraq at the direction of the Russians and Iranians. The Iraqis have nothing to do with it, and the Americans, who have 5,000 personnel in Baghdad.
Right in that big old building.
Oh, in that big old building, 5,000 personnel in Baghdad, and all the weapons that we've provided to Iraq are being orchestrated by the Russians and the Iranians.
And this is somebody they want to trust?
Oh, I mean, the Abominator is either the most maniacal man who ever lived, or the absolute dumbest. And Scott, during their last segment, was trying to say, you know, there's this distinction between maniacal and just buffoon isn't necessarily one that you should make. You can be an idiot who is maniacal, who doesn't understand the consequence of their own actions, who are deliberately working against our interests, but still couldn't fathom all the negative consequences of their belligerence. And on all of these underlying stories, I mean, between the U.S. using the NSA to spy on its own citizens without due process and total violation to the U.S. Constitution, with James Clapper denying it under oath to the U.S. Congress and not being demoted or prosecuted, to the Bush administration at the highest levels, President of the United States, Vice President of the United States, National Security Advisor, authorizing the use of torture, and no one is indicted for it. And then we have the case of Alaki, which is one of the most embarrassing in American history, and the case of Assad being released now, that our behavior was totally and completely dishonest. And yet, no consequence of any of this.
Well, it does, with Russia's involvement, it does point to why 2026 is a good number.
Otherwise, how do you get there?
Really drag it out that long, or yeah, turn it to 2024.
Yeah, how do you get there? And, you know, I think that that something I talked about last week is now making more and more sense. The Russians really, first of all, it's an all-Islamic assault against Israel. And now with the Russians involved in backing Assad against Sunni Islam, with Sunni Islam outnumbering and outgunning Shia Islam, outmanning it 5-1, outgunning them 25-1, this creates a stalemate. I particularly sense of the nuclear deal with the Iranians. It creates a stalemate in what was a guaranteed loss for Iran and Shia Islam.
Does Iran have to participate?
So, no, Iran doesn't have to participate, but I don't think there's any chance that they don't. So here was my thinking, is that while they're beating each other up and they now reach a stalemate because of the Russian involvement and the Chinese support of Iran, all the Russians have to do to ingratiate themselves with Sunni Islam is to do exactly the same thing on behalf of the mythical people known as the Palestinians. The reason we're spending the second hour talking about the events transpiring before our eyes in Syria and how the Ukraine led to it and the crude nature of American politics, really maniacal nature, the malfeasance of America's leaders, both political and military, and what all this leads to is because God, Yahweh, thought it was important enough that he told us 2,700 years ago exactly how this was going to play out. Who was going to do what to whom and what the consequence of all of these actions was going to be. And so if Yahweh is going to tell us specifically that this is the catalyst for World War III, and let us know this, then it's important that we talk about it. If he wouldn't have told us if he didn't think it was important for us to cover this subject.
Right. He talks in great detail from many different angles.
Right. So, specifically as to how this all-Islamic assault against Israel was ultimately going to parlay into the Magog War. Now, what I left that last segment, Kirk and Glenn, talking about is that if, and Putin recently met with Hamas, and he had big ceremony with Hamas in Moscow. If Putin were to do exactly the same thing in Gaza and or also the West Bank that he just did, and his navy is right there. And so if, in fact, Putin were to do the same thing in the West Bank and in Gaza that he just did in Syria, rather than them being the persona non grata among Sunni Muslims, he would be considered the great sheikh of Islam. It put Russia instantly in the most powerful position in the world.
Can you play both sides of the street?
Sure. When the there's one thing that Sunni Muslims hate more than Shia Muslims.
Israel.
Right. There's one thing that Shia Muslims hate more than Sunni Muslims. Israel. And if Putin is, all right, you know, we didn't like this idea of the Sunnis trying to take down Assad. You know, he's the dictator of that country, and we don't want the fundamentalist Muslims taking down the dictator. But tell you what we will do. We will work on your behalf to take down Israel. It would instantly galvanize the world of Islam.
Wow.
So, I think it's inevitable. And, you know, I thought for a long time that it was inevitable that the Islamic State would invade both northern Saudi Arabia, where they will find lots of support, and that they would invade Jordan, which they would find overwhelming support.
Mm-hmm.
So then what? You know, as the activities, because if you look at Israel right now, the Muslims are out slashing throats, and it's been about 4 months since Hamas started a conflict with Israel. I mean, got enough rockets back in its arsenal and enough tunnels built to start terrorizing Israel. It's about time. It's going to happen again. And this time, you know, if you had an all-out war between the mythical people known as the Palestinians, Hamas, and Israel, what would keep Russia from engaging? Is the United States certainly going to stop them?
Well, Israel's not going to sit there and just let them bomb them.
No.
They have nuclear weapons.
No, but can Israel right now can do it whatever it wishes in Gaza and in the West Bank when rockets are fired into Israel from Gaza and the West Bank?
They can retaliate, but not the way they want to.
But what happens if there's Russian fighters there? What if there's Russian anti-aircraft there? What if there's Russian troops there? Then what can Israel do?
Makes
nothing.
It very awkward, doesn't it?
Nothing.
Jeez.
Nothing. The Russian presence in the West Bank should be so menacing to Israel that Israel, rather than having this conversation about the Iranian deal, which all that Israel's presentation against Iran and the Iranian deal does is it aggravates both the United States on one side and Russia on the other, who is in league with them. And Iran's not their problem.
No.
The problem right now is is this all-out civil war that has brought the whole world into Syria and that ultimately will blame Israel. And just as Putin garnered international attention for his intervention in Syria, what would keep him out of Gaza and the West Bank?
So how does this last to 2026 now?
Well, it's the all-out Islamic assault on Israel doesn't begin until 2026, 2027, but it's preceded by the fall of Damascus. So Putin's involvement in Syria precludes the fall of Damascus happening anytime in the next 5 or 6 years. So it just keeps the timeline on the timeline that we've known is going to happen.
Yeah. And almost, and it guarantees nuclear war.
And it guarantees the second phase of the Magog War, where one-third of the Earth becomes uninhabitable and where elements melt in intense heat. The nuclear exchange that, you see, the nuclear exchange wasn't possible with Iran bombing Israel, you know, Putin's fear, because Israel, while bludgeoned, the bludgeoning of Israel is, Yahweh says specifically that that the people are robbed and the women are raped. Well, a nuclear bomb doesn't rob or rape.
No, you there's nothing left.
Right. And well, Yahweh tells his people to flee twice during this. The fact is that it's militants personally marching into Muslims marching into Israel that causes that problem. They're not going to use that. That's not where the nuclear exchange is going to occur. And the nuclear exchange that would be capable of being perpetrated by Iran is not going to set the whole world ablaze. It's only by...
I read this one.
You have to have Europe and the United States in opposition to China and Russia to have a third of the world scorched with a nuclear attack.
That's no one can see this coming? I mean, forget prophecy a minute. No one can see this as a consequence?
You know, I first translated Isaiah 17 probably 10 to 12 years ago. And I had a tough time seeing how Damascus was going to fall, how Syria was going to fall, or that the American invasion of Iraq was going to cause this. But I was able to see that America was, in Isaiah 18, the belligerent. So I knew that God was blaming America for the situation that has transpired, as he should.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see it 10 to 12 years ago when I first translated those passages. Now, today I've got the advantage of being able to look at the situation through the prophecy, and what we're looking at is it's so easy now to put the pieces together. So... you and I don't claim to be the best informed or smartest dudes on the planet.
Hardly.
We're not paid by any government to do research on this. Your wife provides you with your sources and you know, I use a newsfeed to study the news 2 to 3 hours a day and try to connect the pieces so we can do this this program. And yet we figured it out.
No. Well, the people out there know they don't connect the dots the way we do because they're not filtered through the Torah. But
right.
Let me ask you a quick question because it was asked mm-hmm. of me of our friend Jackie in regards to studying in time. Is it more valuable for us to spend more time covering Zechariah and Isaiah or Yahshua?
Mm-hmm.
Versus Revelations. I have some reservations about Revelations because it's in Greek, you know, where the other one is more clear
mm-hmm.
To do. Is it should be when you discuss this, do you bring in Revelations that much?
You know, I think, first of all, we've got really, I think, two questions here. One question is, are we better off spending our time talking about the fact that Pauline Christianity is wholly and completely worthless, counterproductive, and therefore if you are a Christian, and the same thing would be true with Muhammad's Islam, if you were a Muslim, it's in your best interest to leave your religion? Or are we better off talking about socialist secular humanism and it being on a flawed premise so that people are willing to question, so that they're willing to consider Yahweh's testimony? So should we do that? Should we emphasize instead Yahweh's covenant, and his Torah, so people know once they start questioning the things they're dependent upon, whether or not they should go to and what truth is reliable. Or do we spend our time focusing on what Yahweh had to say about the last days, mm-hmm. so that his the validity of and the just amazing nature of his precise presentation some 2,700 years ago of precisely what we're seeing play out in the world would cause people to be interested in what God had to say and trust what he had to say. And then the next is, what is the best approach? Do we do this strictly from Isaiah and Zechariah and Ezekiel and the Torah to put the timeline together? Or do we also include Revelation?
Yeah.
So it's that's that whole series. And let me just deal with the last one.
Sure.
About 4 months ago, I read every prophetic book cover to cover. And in doing it, it was the first really kind of broad-based view I've had of all the things that Yahweh was saying about our day, and that included also Revelation. So I read them all just cover to cover, just over a series of a week or so. And one of the things that struck me was that just as the Olivet Discourse is really a recital of Zechariah,
mm-hmm.
and so the premier and most influential testimony regarding the last days is found in the Olivet Discourse, 24th chapter of Matthew. That is where you find the most information. That almost all of it is a presentation of what's found in Zechariah. What I also found is that if you want to understand Revelation, what you need to do is focus on Yeshayah, Isaiah. That the whole presentation of what Babylon represents and who the what are the spiritual forces that are being released. You need to it's a blend of Daniel
mm-hmm.
and Isaiah provide all the information you need to know about the beast, the purpose of the beast, the timing, the actions, and the forces at play. But it struck me that what was being presented in Revelation was really an integration, primarily of Daniel and Isaiah together, with a little Zechariah thrown in, a little Malachi thrown in, and a little Ezekiel. But primarily, the foundational text for Revelation is Daniel and Isaiah. And if you want to, if you really study Daniel and Isaiah, you'll understand everything that's presented in Revelation. What was Terry's thought, or Jackie's thought in this
Jackie's
regard?
Thought, well, I think she was leaning toward Revelation, but I don't have her email in front of me, but I'm calling from the day before yesterday, I think, or early yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
She was very interested, and I remember Revelations being part of it. And to me, from day one, long even in Christian days, Revelation was Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
A few little tidbits thrown in that you may not pick up through Daniel, but I'd always looked at it as...
Yeah, except you never know, you don't know Satan's association with Babylon without Isaiah.
Yeah. So,
it's Isaiah 14 that establishes the Babylonian satanic orientation.
And then knowing that Yahweh said that the Torah is complete in every way, and
right.
So that adds some mm-hmm. weight to me, to my personal thinking. And then, of course, it's so hard for me to look up Greek.
I know. See, that's the biggest issue.
What word were they translating in Hebrew?
You know, you don't have anything from Isaiah 17, Revelation 17 to the end of the book and anything pre-Constantine. And so, you know, now you're just, that's a crapshoot as to what part of that's reliable.
So that's my problem.
Right. And then you take the book of Yahuchanan, and it's one of the most highly copy-edited of all of the text in terms of just altered to suit Christianity. And so this is a Yahuwkanon text, you know, and that he wrote Revelation. And then you've got the issue of the oldest manuscripts are in Greek. And none of this conversation took place in Greek. And now trying to adjust Greek for the from the to the Hebrew prophetic mindset. Wow. I mean, I understand that there are some insights and revelation that would probably help us put together the pieces so we better understand the timing and the events that are portrayed in Isaiah and Daniel. Yeah, my gut just does somersaults when I think that I'm going to be reliant on a Greek text found in the Christian New Testament. The only book that I really find that I'm the least bit comfortable in is Matthew.
Yeah. It's pretty straightforward, too.
You know, because it was originally written in Hebrew by an eyewitness. And so, you know, I'm pretty comfortable there, and I get out of that, and gosh, I get uncomfortable.
I think Jackie was just concerned because so many people, as the new people listen to the program, and they want to make sure we don't, I don't think I go over anybody's head. But sometimes when we talk, you know, we're talking, to someone new is confusing, perhaps, but and everybody, and a lot of Christians that listen would know the first time, they would know Revelations better than the,
right.
The Torah, but the Torah certainly is clearer to me.
Yes. Oh, it's you know, I find it extraordinarily easy to translate and understand the Torah.
Yeah.
I find translating and understanding Isaiah to be by far the most difficult of any of the prophetic books. And that's because the vocabulary for Isaiah is so different than the rest. That you know, every word becomes as a challenge, and there's so many words in Isaiah that are where different words are translated with the same word in English, and so you have to focus on what are their nuances, what are their shadings. So it takes forever for me to translate Isaiah, and then Daniel I think is fairly easy to render, but you know to put Daniel in the context of today's events, you really need Isaiah, and I'm sure that Revelation would probably give us some kind of added handrail in the midst of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, I hate to base a study on Revelation. Just because of the inaccuracy of the text and the fact that it's recorded in Greek.
You know, even in bad English translations on the Torah, this morning I was doing Zechariah and the 14th and chapters and all, and even though they say Lord, Lord, and all this kind of stuff on there, when you look up the Hebrew translation right away on those words, even if it's a strong number or even if it's just a Yara or something like that, I couldn't believe how many times I found spelled out in Hebrew, Yahweh. Yah.
Really?
Yeah. And they all know. And we're talking about, what's the NASA? That's the...
NASB, New American Standard Bible.
Like that. I mean, I couldn't believe in that translation how many times I look at the word and I say, Yahweh.
Yeah.
These folks know. They just lie through the teeth.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we know the introduction to the New American Standard Bible says that, I remember reading it one time because it was just so amazing. I actually printed it and yada yada. It says that, you know, that the name, and they have it as Yahweh versus Yahweh, holds no significance in the religious community, and therefore we're not going to use it. It has no merit whatsoever. So we're going to discard the fact that it's there. And we're going to call ourselves a literal translation. And we're going to replace the name that we know is there 7,000 times with the two other words of our own choosing, the Lord. And you say, so, yeah, they know what they're doing. So that, you know, so there's a group of people making a living publishing Bibles that they say are the inerrant word of God. And knowing that what they're doing is a farce, so why wouldn't we suspect the Obaminator and others in the U.S. government of deliberately engulfing the world in war. It serves their interests.
Gosh. It's just, it's very,
it really does give me cold feet, though, when I think about, could the Obaminator and his allies actually have established the ruse that we witnessed in the Ukraine specifically for all of this to materialize so that the world was aligned for war?
Well, you keep poking somebody with a stick, you know.
Yeah, but it's more than that. It was far more than that with Putin. I mean, it was a very elaborate scheme that was created, and then at the same time to put Russia in a position where their primary economic partner is Iran, which you knew they were going to defend, and now they have their general strategizing with using American weapons, and the most dangerous place in the world in Syria. While at the same time that we are creating this division between Europe and Russia,
if you read the history
and taunting China,
the Russians signed all the same type of agreements with Yugoslavia and all that area, and they said when they went to war and the things that came out later that you can read, they say to one another, they say, why are we doing this? This is going to lead to a war with France and a war with England and everybody in Germany, and it's going to be pardoned.
Why are we doing this?
It's because we signed an agreement. And by God, they'll do it.
Yeah, I've got goosebumps thinking about, rather than just being stupid, not understanding the consequence of their actions, that world leaders have actually fashioned this prelogue to World War III that we're witnessing, and that billions of people are going to be sacrificed for their ego.